pants on the ground, pants on the ground, looking like a fool with your pants on the ground, and the goal in your mouth, hat turned sideways, pants hit the ground, thinking you're a cool cat walking downtown with your pants on the ground.
Welcome to the Serotalk Podcast.
Serotalk Podcast.
Welcome to the Serotalk Podcast, your portal to the accessible digital lifestyle.
www.serotalk.com.
A production of Serotech Corporation, creators of System Access, the System Access Mobile Network, and SA2Go. Learn about new technology, cool software, useful websites, education, information, entertainment, user comments, and much more. And now, here's your host, Michael Law.
Welcome to Serotalk. For January 18, 2010, this is Michael Loff.
I'm Ricky Inger.
Well, this is our first podcast, in a way, for 2010. Of course, what we posted 2 weeks ago was our documentary, The Serotech Story. And I just thought it was cool to call it Part 1, although normally you don't call Part 1, I guess. But it confused people because where's Part 2?
Well, we're living it right now, aren't we?
That's what I meant, folks. Part 2 is here and now. You're living it. From this point forward, we're living Part 2 of The Serotech Story. If you haven't listened to it yet, it's pretty interesting. A lot of work that took. I know well over 40 hours for myself, and I think even Mikey played with it for 10 to 15 hours doing post-production.
Yeah, there was a lot of material, a lot of history to go through. A fascinating listen. It certainly was for me. There were lots of things I never knew.
Trip down memory lane for myself, even a couple production bits that I'd never heard before that Mikey did. We's going to be at ATIA on the 27th through the 30th in Orlando, Florida. So I hope if you're there, you'll drop by our booth. What is it, 520, I believe?
Yep, that's what it is. We'll be in the Caribe Royale Hotel. That's the official ATIA hotel and has been for quite some time. So drop by booth 520 and see all the goodies that we are going to be showing off. Take advantage of the Build-A-Bundle packages that we have just released. This is a way that you can customize your package of Serotech products and services. So you can purchase system access licenses beginning at $9.95 for a single license and going all the way up to $29.95. That'll get you 5 licenses so you can get outfitted on all your computers or 4 computers plus a thumb drive. You can also get subscription to Samnet, or rather a rental of Samnet. That starts at $9.95 to get you all the great content of Samnet. You can also just get the remote access to your home machine or another Serotech customer's machine. That's $9.95. If you want them both, $14.95 will get it for you.
That's right, and those are monthly prices. There is a $25 one-time activation fee, and once you pay that, you never have to pay it again. So if you use it for a couple of months, come back a year later, you don't have to pay that. But for a limited time, we are throwing in with that $25 activation fee, Eloquence, my favorite speech engine. So this is the time to take advantage of it and maybe share it with some family members or friends, folks needing a screen reader. Get it for them a couple of months, let them play with it, or just add other machines. You know, the average household now has 4 machines, so you get 2 licenses and maybe you need a few more. So that's the way to do it. Also, I just saw that we were nominated to Blind Bargains. They're doing their 2009 Access Awards.
Access there. Awards, yep.
So you can go over there and vote on your favorite hardware and software and all that cool stuff. So if you like the Serotalk podcast, or you like the fact that we've eliminated the software maintenance agreements, you just like what we're doing, or certainly want to vote for any of the other great technologies that have been nominated over there, you may do so by going to blindbargains.com.
I, for one, am pretty honored that Serotech and the Serotalk podcast has been nominated for so many categories. I think we show up in 3 different categories, Serotech does. Maybe 4, actually. The Serotalk podcast is nominated. We're in with a great crowd, like ACB Radio and the Blind World podcast, also nominated. So go and show your support for all the new hardware and software that you loved in 2009, and vote for us if you like.
Serotalk, because we rock.
Indeed.
Hey, one other special we've extended, Accessible Events. You can get that free account set up for yourself as a presenter plus three participants. That's going on through January 31st over at accessibleevent.com. So great if you just in a workplace and maybe you're the only visually impaired person and you want to take part in the company webinars, or maybe you need something you can hand your professor to make those presentations accessible for you. It's a great tool. So get it while it's hot through the end of January. Well, let's see what's going on here in tech news. Of course, all of the latest stuff is in the Socializer, so SamNet members can take advantage of that. And of course, always go to serotalk.com for links to the stuff that we talk about. Now, this will already have passed by the time you hear it, but Accessible World Tech Talk that takes place tonight as we record this on the 18th is talking about what's cool from CES. That was the Consumer Electronics Show that recently took place in Las Vegas. I'll be curious to see what things they happen to bring up. Also, NFB blog addressed some of these things as well. One thing I thought was kind of cool is going to be a new voice-activated or voice-driven remote from RCA that's supposed to launch this spring for $39. You'll have product codes so you can enter many of your popular electronic devices. This is, of course, for folks with home theater, at least stereo systems and TVs and DVD players and all that cool stuff. You can also do macros. So in other words, you could set up a series of commands. Say you want to watch a movie. You can have it turn on the TV, turn on the DVD player, you know, turn on your amplifier for your speakers. So you can do a whole myriad of commands with macros. That's very exciting because a lot of blind folks are interested in home theater and it's never really been accessible short of interfacing it with your computer.
Everybody wants voice-activated remotes. So this is a perfect example of, they call it a universal remote, but it's universal design in action there, something that's of use to everyone, whether they can read the screen and the buttons on the remote or not.
Right, so you can read more at www.rcaaccessories.com. There was one other thing talking about some kind of Blackfire Wi-Fi speaker, so I'm not sure why, but you could hook all your devices through Wi-Fi to a central speaker. So unless it really sounded good, I can't even get my head around exactly what it is. But if you're interested, you can go read about that over at their blog. I got an email asking me to cover this Ocean Blue talking set-top box that has been released in the UK. And I said, well, it'll probably be some time before it comes to the USA. And reading this blog, looks like the NFB is working and trying to get their hand in making that happen. They're trying to find a US broadcaster to partner with to make it happen so that we can have an accessible set-top box in the USA. Is that something you would buy, or how much would you pay for it?
You know, that's interesting. I've become so used to barely knowing what channel I'm on and what the program is that's showing, but I would love to have that information and the ability to see if there's a DVS track and turn it on independently, because right now you really have to go through some contortions to turn on the secondary audio programming on the TV so that you can get your described video or your Spanish or whatever language it's being shown. But with this, it talks, so you can do everything independently. So the folks at the NFB who were taking a look at this did write about it briefly in their blog, and the review was very favorable. It looks to be quite usable.
So I'm very excited about that. A lot of folks do enjoy TV. I can tell by looking at the stats of people who use SamNet to get TV listings. Once something in the States is available, you will hear about it right here on Serotalk, the podcast that rocks. Let's see, a couple other little things here. Free webinar going on this Wednesday from EASY, EASI. That's what Bernard Coombs, I believe. It's 1900 GMT, talking about access to the Android phone. So I know a lot of people have asked about that. And of course, we can't find anyone to demo that it actually works or how well it works or what its limitations are. I'm not too optimistic at this point to make any investment in it.
Yeah, I've seen the Eyes Free channel on YouTube, and a blog has just been launched by Dr. TV Rahman talking about the Eyes Free project. But from what I've seen so far, there are certain applications which are accessible, but it's not so across the board. Looking forward to this webinar to give us a better exploration of what is currently possible with Android, where they're hoping to go, and what's not accessible.
Looks like there are now free RFBND keys for the BookSense. RFBND, where it's got the latest firmware on there, which is in the States, and it's also available now in the UK. So take advantage of that if you own that. Now, is this correct? The BookSense, is that the only one of these players that supports iTunes?
To my knowledge, yes, it is.
Coming up on the podcast later in our career segment, we're going to speak with a really good guy, Dr. Robert Carter. And he's a staff psychologist over at Texas A&M University. We're also going to dispel a myth. People keep saying Skype 4.0 is not accessible, and it is, and we're going to show you some settings to change to make sure that it is usable for yourself, regardless of which screen reader you use. Also, we'll show you a couple settings you want to change to make sure that Skype doesn't play with your sound card, because a few people have had a very mean and nasty thing happen where their sound gets turned down, and it's Skype doing it, and of course, when your sound is down, your speech is down. Well, I've got some good news and some bad news for you folks. The good news is Skype for the iPhone is now accessible. The main limitation in the past was that the contacts were unusable, but they are now, and a lot of us have already installed it over the past weekend. And you're going to hear, not only is it accessible and pretty easy to use, as many iPhone apps are, but also the sound quality on both the phone and the speakerphone are
it's very phenomenal.
Good. Yes, it is really good. So you're going to get to hear that. So that's good news in the sense that we've enhanced accessibility for another iPhone application. Now, the bad news, and what I'm really quite upset about, and I hope you'll join us in writing letters and letting this company know, especially if you've spent the money for it, is we have taken a step backwards in something that has been promoted quite heavily on the Sero Talk podcast, and I know many people have bought it through our promotion, and that's Navigon. Ricky, why don't you tell folks what's happening over there?
So Navigon, the GPS app for the iPhone, with its latest update, they have actually disabled voice guidance when you have it set in pedestrian mode. So if you're driving around in the car, you still get those turn-by-turn directions. But when it's in pedestrian mode, you can still read things with voiceover, but you don't get that very convenient voice guidance. And this is a huge step backwards, considering that many of us were really singing Navigon's praises for being the most economical and most accessible GPS solution that was developed for the mainstream but still works for blind folks as well. A couple of people have written to Navigon and asked about reinstating the voice guidance in pedestrian mode. And the response, unfortunately, was a form letter basically stating, no, we cannot reinstate this. Thank you for writing. And if you need anything else, contact us. Turns out we do need something and we should contact them. They do not have just a direct email address for support. It's one of those where you go to the website, you fill out a form, including your name, and you write your email in an edit box on that form. So go head over to serotalk.com, check out the show notes, and get the info for where to send your 2 cents. But we really want to let Navigon know just how many of us there are and just how important we find this. We've spent our money, we've done a lot to support the company, and now we really need to stand up and say, hey, wait a minute, you've taken a step back, you need to fix it, or the hundreds and perhaps even thousands of customers that are blind may be looking elsewhere and certainly won't be singing your praises anymore.
That's right. So I hope you go to serotalk.com. We'll have a link there, and you know, let's make it happen, or someone start a petition. Let's let them know. We've spent the money. People have spent anywhere from $59 to $89 for the product, and still not quite where we hoped it would be, but now I'm very upset that they've totally gone backwards on this. So let's let our voices be heard. The next podcast, February 1st, will be some highlights from ATIA. Make sure to be listening to SamNet Radio, the 27th through the 30th, as well as, if you're not doing so, following Serotalk on Twitter at twitter.com/Serotalk, as we will be letting you know of cool things that we find based on what announcements are being made by companies and what interviews we are able to get. And if you're in the area, by all means, come by booth 520 and say hello to Ricky or myself or Mike Cowell. Any final words?
From 103.
Get out of here, Brian.
Go away, Brian.
D&D.
So that's right. If you are attending ATIA, come see us in booth 520. And if we don't see you there, we will see you in 2 weeks.
I want to talk about a program that has become very popular called Skype, spelled S-K-Y-P-E. Most people listening to this podcast are probably using it, or have at least heard of it. Many people are staying with an older version, 3.8, because of some changes made to version 4.1, leaving them unsure how to make it accessible. We will show you how to make these few but necessary changes to improve accessibility not only with System Access, but all screen readers. First off, if you don't have the application, you can go to www.skype, that's spelled skype.com, and follow the clearly labeled links that say download to get the latest version. Persons already using 3.8 can go into an upgrade option, although from what I've read, you may have problems doing that, and it is preferred, at least to get to 4, to uninstall your current version by clicking the Start button, going into Settings, Control Panel, Add Remove Programs, and down arrowing until you hear the word Skype, and then removing the application, and then installing the new version. But that's a personal choice. What I'm going to focus on today is showing you how to make these changes under the View and Tools menus to give you improved accessibility. As we record this on January 18th, 2010, the latest version is 4.1.079. I am using 4.2, which is still in beta, and I have had no problems. I've been using it for quite some time. It adds a couple of features, including the ability to use on local Wi-Fi networks. Great if you have an iPhone or a portable device or a laptop or netbook. And it has also added the ability to transfer calls from your computer to a conventional phone if you're paying for some Skype out minutes. So you could, for example, transfer it to your cell phone and then take off and continue your phone call. Or to a landline phone, maybe you want to take the phone in another room for some privacy. So let's look at the options here. Once the program is installed, we will first click on the View menu by pressing Alt-V.
View menu open. Contacts Alt-1. Checked.
Now, it mentions Contacts Alt-1, and that's important because you have different views when you switch to version 4, like
Conversations Alt-2.
Conversations, which you get to by pressing Alt-2.
History Alt-3.
And History for Alt-3. Oftentimes, when you finish a call, you will be in your History view, so to get back to your contacts, you will press Alt-1. Likewise,
Conversations Alt-2.
To get back to your conversations, current communications that you're engaging in, it's Alt-2 for the Conversations menu, or for the History view, to look at your most recent activity, it is Alt-3.
History Alt-3. H. Notifications. N.
Also under here, we have Notifications.
Call Phones. A.
Call Phones.
Directory.
Directory.
D. Shop.
S. Shop.
Compact View. M.
And what's called Compact View. I am told that this improves accessibility for chat. I don't chat with Skype, so I cannot verify this, but if you plan to type back and forth to folks, you might press Enter. Go to the Compact View for that purpose. But mainly what I want to focus on is under the Tools menu, which we can get to by pressing Alt-T.
Tools menu open, extra submenu, change language submenu, accessibility submenu.
There's an accessibility submenu, and when you hear submenu, that means press Enter.
Menu open, extended keyboard navigation, checked.
There's only one option in here called extended keyboard navigation. By default, when you first install, it will be unchecked, and you simply press Enter to toggle its state. If it is already checked for some reason, then press Escape.
Accessibility submenu, A.
Now, what I want to go to are the options. Press Alt-T.
Menu open. Extra submenu, E.
Press the letter O for options.
Skype trademark, data options, options, tree, general, close.
And what you have is a tree view of options, meaning instead of tabs that you go left and right, you up and down arrow to move through the options. There are only a few things that I'm going to focus on today, those being the most important that need to be changed. By default, you're at the top of this list, which is the General tab.
When I double-click on the contact, start a call, checkbox, checked.
The first one, when I double-click on a contact, start a call. By default, this is unchecked. Press the space bar to check this box. Now, when you press Enter on a contact in your list, again, remember which we get to by pressing Alt-1 if it's not immediately viewable, when you press Enter on a contact, it will immediately initiate a call to them. What else do we have in here that we might want to change? One other thing.
Editable text, 5. Start Skype when I start Windows. Checkbox, not checked.
Here's a personal preference. Start Skype when I start Windows. If you want Skype to come up every time, then check this box. By default, it is checked. I unchecked it. I want Skype there when I want it. If you're like me and sometimes want to be public and other times want to be private, make sure this is unchecked. Then you can simply click on the Skype link that's on your desktop to start it when you wish to communicate with others.
Set program language to drop-down list, English, show online user account and contact list, checkbox, checked, classic Windows, radio button, selected.
Here is the one that we want to change. It says classic view. By default, it is set to Skype.
Skype, radio button, selected.
When you get it, it is set to Skype. So simply press down arrow.
Classic Windows, radio button, selected.
To classic Windows. That is very important to have that one set to classic Windows.
Rich label, change your picture, save button.
Then you're on the save button. If you wish to do nothing else, you can simply press space bar and leave, or you can go ahead and make some other changes in here. So I will tab a little bit more.
Cancel button, options, 3, general settings, general audio.
Twice more to show you some other options. If we down arrow once.
Audio settings, set up sound on your computer.
We get audio settings.
Drop down list, SD Audio to audio AC0.
Tapping once lands you on where you choose which device you wish to use. If you have multiple sound cards or sound devices, here you can specify which is your input device, meaning what you use to talk to each other, and the output device, where the audio is played to. That could be your USB device or your sound card.
Volume control, recording level, slider, 0.
There's your volume control.
Automatically adjust microphone settings, checkbox, not checked.
Automatically adjust microphone settings. I would leave this unchecked. Skype by default wants to control your sound card, and I have seen many problems with this, including it turning the sound card all the way down, which for those of us who do not see means we actually lose speech. So I would uncheck anything regarding allowing Skype to adjust my audio.
Drop-down list, SD Audio to audio AC00.
Now here's the other drop-down where you decide which sound card you want to use.
Volume control, resume call button, adjust call volume, slider 80, automatically adjust speaker settings, checkbox, not checked.
The most important one, automatically adjust speaker settings. Again, this is checked by default. Definitely, most definitely, uncheck this one so that Skype will not, when you least expect it or least desire it, for some crazy reason on certain sound cards, decide it wants to turn your sound all the way down, leaving you without speech.
Drop down list, use selected speaker, show advanced options button, rich label, make a free test call, link, rich label, learn more about setting up, rich label, via et cetera, Skype, save button.
And we are back to the save button. There are many other options here, but I'm going to tab twice to the tree view.
Cancel button options.
I'm going to go down to the very bottom, which is the hotkeys.
Hotkey, enable keyboard shortcuts, checkbox, checked.
The hotkey option, which is the very last one, 29 of 29, the first checkbox will be unchecked by default, and it's enable hotkeys. You'll want to check that and then tab once again to check the boxes for the hotkeys you wish to use.
List.
There are two hotkeys that you'll want to check. These enable you to answer and hang up calls using a keyboard shortcut rather than having to go into the menus.
Action, answer call, hotkey, OTG up, checked.
The first one is answer call, and by default it is unchecked. If you check it, then when someone calls you, simply press Alt page up to answer and begin speaking with the other party. If we down arrow once,
action, answer call with video, hotkey, CTRL, OTG up, checked.
That answer call with video, control Alt page up. Great if you have a webcam if someone is initiating a video call.
Action, ignore call, not checked. Free action, hang up, hotkey, OTGDN, checked.
And the last one we definitely want to check is the hang up call. Check this box. You can press Alt page down from anywhere in Windows to terminate the call. There are many other options you may wish to look through, but these are the essential things that you'll want to do to get Skype working correctly for you. I will simply press Shift Tab.
Enable keyboard shortcut options, 3, cancel button, save button.
To the save button and press the space bar or enter. One more thing I want to show you in Skype is how to hear what you sound like. Skype has a service called, as will happen, I don't have access to my contacts. So what do we do? Again, Alt 1.
Skype trademark, beta 2, makeup, contact list, list, Skype test call, online, not selected.
Now what it says is Skype test call. You will not see this option until you initially say you want to make a call to Echo 123. That's called Skype test call and allows you to, well, let me just show you what happens. I will press enter.
Skype test call, Skype tab, eye contact profile, editable text, blank.
Hello, welcome to Skype call testing service. After the beep, please record a message. Afterwards, your message will be played back to you.
I just love her voice. I wonder how many men love her voice. Testing 1, 2, 3. Good check. I just love her voice. I wonder how many men love her voice. Testing 1, 2, 3.
If you are able to hear your own voice, then you have configured Skype correctly. If you hear this message, but not your own voice, then something is wrong with your audio
now,
recording
settings. Now, again, I can terminate by pressing Alt page
Please
down.
Check your microphone and microphone settings.
Skype. Hold this.
And the call is finished. So there are many other things you can do, but that should be enough to get you started. And if you wonder what Skype sounds like, remember that most conversations in the Serotalk podcast and every bit of audio in this podcast was done using Skype. So talk to family and friends. Calls to other computer users are absolutely free. You can buy some Skype Out credit, which will allow you to call individual phone numbers, or what we call landline phones, or cell phones. Likewise, you can buy what's called a Skype In number. This is an actual phone number that people can call, and if you're online, we'll ring Skype. If you're not online, we'll go to voicemail, which you can listen to at a later time. Skype also supports video, so if you have a webcam, you can talk with family members and friends and see each other. Maybe even if you yourself are blind, it is nice for those who can see to actually see you, if you wish to do so. And video is always disabled by default. You have to actually enable video for each call. The Macintosh, however, I believe you check the box and then it will always begin with video, assuming that you knew that you always want to have video calls. But there's just a quick getting started guide to using Skype. We hope if you wish to communicate with family and friends, you will consider this awesome, high quality, and free for computer use application. People have been waiting for this. There's been rumors of an accessible Skype for the iPhone, but it has been released. And joining me now to give us a little demo of how it works is Scott Rakowski.
How are you, Michael?
Very good, Scotty. Had it a day or so, right? What are your thoughts on the new Skype for the iPhone?
Well, I'm actually very impressed with it in the fact that the contacts are now fully accessible. And in the past, when you tried to use them on the iPhone, you got just letters like A, B, C, D, E, F, G. But now when you swipe across the phone, you get all your contacts listed. You can show them by online contacts only or all contacts. You can also chat. I haven't tested that feature out, but you can chat. You can send SMSs from Skype if you've got credit. There's a My Info tab, and you can change different settings, such as your profile settings, your status, whether you're online, away, invisible. A couple of things I have noticed off the bat is that it doesn't support conference calling, so you can't be on one call and add a second person. Just can't be done. I think it's got something to do with probably processing power of the iPhone. The other thing it doesn't have is if you're on a call and somebody rings you on Skype, it goes to voicemail, or it'll just ring out if you don't have voicemail.
Why don't you give us a little demo of the main screen, any options you want. And then what we're going to do, folks, is we're going to switch. Scotty's on this Macintosh right now. And then we're going to disconnect and reconnect so you can hear the sound quality of how he sounds talking through his iPhone.
When you're on the iPhone on Skype, it actually says your username or whatever on mobile device. Is that what it said?
Right, it said Scott Rakowski on mobile device. So you know when you're logged in via your iPhone, people can tell that you're on a mobile device. Just as it also did with the other app, NimBuzz, also gave that. So that's a Skype thing when you're using a mobile device.
I'm just going into Skype now. There is also a settings dialog in the main iPhone page where you can just turn on and off whether you lock your phone, whether Skype stays online.
If your screen is set to lock after a minute, so if you're on the speakerphone, once that screen locks, it puts the caller on hold.
Yeah, that's true. So just loading now. So we'll just go to the start of the screen here. So the first thing you get on the screen is
groups button.
There's a groups button, so you can change between online and offline contacts. I've got it showing my online contacts at the moment. So you get, for example,
online contacts,
which is what I want it to show.
Add button.
There's an add, so you can add a new contact.
Search text field.
There's a search, so you can search for a contact, I assume, or could probably type in a phone number there and dial it, but I don't know if that's what the box is for. I haven't tested that out yet, because I've only had this for about 8 hours so far.
Adam Rutkowski.
So there's a contact.
Dane Truth Allen.
Another contact here.
Gary Purse. Contacts.
Just say we want to know if a contact's online. We'll go to one of them now.
Sir. Gary Purse.
I'll just pick this one here.
Gary Purse. Online contacts.
If you swipe over.
Gary Purse. Cogwheel _17x17. Button.
Now that button is so you can block a contact, remove a contact. I'm assuming it's kind of like doing a Vo Shift M to get the context menu on a Mac on Skype, or on the Windows, press context key or Shift F10 if you're using system access on a Windows machine. But I just double tapped on the contact to bring up this screen of options.
Gary Purse. Gary Allen Purse.
So it's got his name and his Skype name. It's also got...
It's as bad as you think, and they are out to get you.
That's his, like, little event message where you can put, like, an event next to your name.
Status, online.
So it says that he's online.
Call button.
I can call. If I click on call, I'll get options to either call his cell phone or call him on Skype if he has multiple numbers listed, which he does. I won't go in there because I don't want to give out the details of his number. But if there are no other options listed in the contact, like mobile phone number or anything, it'll just call him on Skype. You also get, if you keep swiping...
Chat button.
A chat button. You can chat with him. I haven't tried that feature yet.
SMS button.
SMS. You can send him an SMS.
View full profile.
You can view the full profile of the person.
11:28 GMT plus 10, Brisbane,
that's the,
Australia.
The time and where he's located.
Contacts, selected.
And then you've got button. The tabs at the bottom of the screen. So contacts.
Chats, button.
Chats.
Call, button.
Call, that's to call a normal phone. If you've got Skype Out credit or a Skype subscription, you can call like landlines or cell phones in different countries.
History, button.
The history where you can view the history of your calls you've made, calls that have come in, etc.
My info. Button.
This is the tab which I went into earlier, and just to show you quickly what you get.
My info, camera, button.
Do different things with the camera, like take a picture of yourself and use it as your profile picture. Kind of cool feature there, which I'd never use, but it's there for anyone who wants it.
Scott.
That's my name.
Sign out, button.
Sign out of your Skype account if you want to log in with another account, if you've got a second Skype account.
Scott, Worm 1000.
That's the Skype username.
Scott, text field. Status.
You can change your status.
My profile.
Your profile.
Call forwarding.
You can forward all your Skype calls to a landline, another Skype user, etc.
Skype credit.
There's your Skype credit, so it tells you how much credit you got left. You can also buy more through the app. Very, very cool.
Online number.
It tells you if you've got any online Skype numbers and you can renew it or buy more.
Voicemail.
And the same with voicemail.
Contacts.
And that's pretty much what you get there.
Do we know if it does video?
I don't know, to be honest. I don't know if it can because you've only got a camera on the back of the phone. You don't have a front-facing camera like on other cell phones to do video calling. I wouldn't have thought it would do video, but I could be wrong.
Probably not if you haven't seen a video option, so we really don't know on that one. But the other thing that we do know is that it is still limited to your Wi-Fi connection. Is that correct? You cannot leave your Wi-Fi and go out and use it on a 3G network.
That's correct. I had a look in what's new in this 1.3 release on the App Store, and it didn't mention anything about 3G usability. It just said that it fixed some bugs and added a couple of things. The major accessibility hurdle for all of us is the fact that all the contacts readers have demoed.
Now, you said the voicemails. Can you show
the
voicemail?
It doesn't show how many. Well, I don't have any voicemails on my phone at the moment, but you go into the history tab, and basically when you go in there, you can choose to see all events, missed events, or new events. You can swipe through the different events. It'll tell you, like, voicemail, who it's from. There's a play button, and you can actually tap the edit button if you want to go and delete events. It's just like deleting a text message on a phone in the iPhone. So you just go to edit, tap the delete switch, and there's a delete button to the right of the events information. Self-explanatory if you're used to the iPhone and deleting text messages.
The Skype application is free. Of course, their revenue is derived from hoping you buy some minutes or a number, some Skype out credit, or a Skype.
I'm also very impressed with the fact that the call quality, as you will hear shortly, is absolutely fantastic. And all the buttons on a call, which I'm going to show shortly as well, are accessible, such as hold, mute, speakerphone. I'm not going to worry about showing you the settings dialog in the main page because there's not really that much in there that you can change, but you can all explore that when you download the app from the on the App Store and try it for yourself.
Okay, well, if there's nothing else, why don't we disconnect and you can call me from your iPhone and we'll let people hear what that sounds like and you can show them the options when you're in a call.
Okay, sounds like a good idea to me.
Hello, Michael.
Hello, Scotty.
I'm here on the iPhone talking to Michael, and I just had to tap the answer button. Basically, when the phone rings, it sort of rings like an old-fashioned phone, and it sort of sometimes tells you who's calling, but other times you just swipe left or right to hear who's calling, and then you'll have a decline and answer, and I think that's pretty much all you get. If you don't answer within, I think it's 15 seconds, it goes to voicemail. I haven't worked out yet if you can increase that timeout if you got voicemail, but as you can hear, the quality is absolutely fantastic. So I'll switch over to the speakerphone. I'll just find the button. The other trick to this is move the phone away from your ear so the proximity sensor will know that you don't have the phone near your head. Otherwise, you won't be able to swipe on any buttons. So I'll just look for the speakerphone button now.
Selected.
Okay, I'm now on the speakerphone, as you can all hear. When Michael called me earlier, I couldn't locate any of those buttons like hold, mute, end call, speakerphone button. I'll show you what you get on the screen just so you have an idea. Okay, here's the left edge of the screen.
Nikub.
That's his name.
0048.
That's how long we've been chatting.
QQ underscore good underscore 22x22 button.
I don't know what that button's for, but I'm not going to click it in case it drops us.
Mute button.
There's a mute button.
Speaker selected.
That's to toggle between speakerphone and earpiece.
Hold button.
There's a hold button.
Dial pad button.
There's a dial pad button.
End call button.
End call.
Contacts button.
And you've got your tabs at the bottom that I showed you earlier.
Hold speaker.
And now I'm back on the earpiece.
So we tried the hold button. That works well. So you can put a person on hold if you need to do something really quickly. But again, as we mentioned, you can't conference call. So someone else would have to handle the conference side of it. Then certainly you could participate as a third party.
From what I've explored, it doesn't appear that you can conference anyway, because when you try to, it says you've got a call in progress. You must end the call first before you call another party.
For reasons of processor power and bandwidth, that's probably why you can only do one call at a time.
Which doesn't upset me all that much, because most of the time you're just talking one-on-one anyway, on a mobile device.
Well, hopefully soon, those of us in the U.S. and maybe other parts of the world, your carriers will allow us to use this on the 3G network. Although I'm sure there will be a fight, because obviously they make their money from minutes. And if we're using data to do voice calls, they could lose on that. And maybe that's part of why AT&T and even Verizon, who is rumored to soon be offering the iPhone, have dropped their unlimited data and voice plans by $30 per month.
It appears for some reason that you can't get calls when the screen is locked. So you have to leave Skype open, it looks like, and it doesn't go to sleep. But it'll drain your battery pretty quick.
If the screen is locked and I call you, it'll just go to voicemail? It won't?
When I did testing earlier, that's what appeared to be the case. Because there is that checkbox under settings that said, when screen is locked, remain online or something like that. I don't know what it does without that box being ticked, so I'm going to go and untick that box later and just see what that actually does. So this is something for people to be aware of. By default, the box is not ticked. It's a 5 megabyte download from the App Store, so you can either download it from your Mac, your Windows machine, or your iPhone. I actually got mine from the iPhone. I think they'll be making more updates as time goes by, but for the most part, I feel that they've done a really good job making it accessible. The contacts are really, really cool. I haven't tried double tapping and holding on a contact to see if anything happens or you get any choices, so I don't know how to delete contacts yet from the iPhone if you wish to do so. If I find anything major or groundbreaking, that I'll let everybody here on the podcast know what that is.
Thank you very much, Scotty. And as you can hear, the sound quality is really good. And now when you call me, and I'm sure many other listeners of the Cero Talk podcast, if you see the word mobile device by their name, you might just be talking to them on their iPhone.
It's opened up Skype for anybody who owns an iPhone. In conjunction as having system access on your PC or on a virtual machine on your Mac and Skype on the iPhone, you've got the best of both worlds.
In our continuing series on looking at different vocations, today we're speaking with Dr. Robert Carter, staff psychologist at Texas A&M University. Robert, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here.
Give us a little background on yourself and how you got to where you are today.
I was born in 1956 to a family who lived in North Carolina, and my parents were blue-collar working folks. My dad was a construction worker. My mom, once I was born, became a stay-at-home mom. I was part of a set of twins. My twin sister died shortly after birth. We were both very premature, which resulted in total blindness for me, a common condition for quite a few folks. When I was around age 4, my mom and I took a trip to the State School for the Blind in Raleigh, North Carolina, the Governor Moorhead School. Neither of us liked it. She didn't want me to be away, nor was she very pleased with the school, with the environment. My mom has very good intuition. So I did not attend the Governor Moorhead School. My parents started seeking a place where I could go to school and in public school. And at that time, early 1960s, they were just starting to mainstream people with disabilities into the school systems in North Carolina. I was one of the first people to be mainstreamed, but the local town where we lived would not take me in the public school system. So my parents elected for us to move about 35 miles away to Charlotte, North Carolina, where I went to public school. And I was in the classroom most of the day with the rest of the students in my grade, but for about an hour a day, I would spend with a resource teacher learning Braille and touch typing and some rudimentary mobility skills. I finished high school in Charlotte and went to the University of North Carolina for undergraduate school, Chapel Hill. Loved Chapel Hill. Was an English major there, and when I was a junior, decided I thought I maybe should get a teaching certificate so that I could teach, because I didn't see much job opportunity in English. But the university told me no, that a blind person probably couldn't handle the classroom and that I should not get a teaching certificate. Of course, these days we would probably protest that. Today, probably university wouldn't say that, but they did at that time, and I didn't really care that much. I wasn't that hot on being a teacher anyway, so I said okay and let that go, which is a little bit surprising in some ways when I look back on it. Given that I was a pretty good advocate for myself, I'd really learned to advocate for what I needed and what I wanted because my mom had been so good at that when I was a kid. So anyway, I finished college there at the University of North Carolina and had been doing some counseling with a summer program over the summers to earn some money while I was in college. Enjoyed the counseling process, so I went to a small university and got a master's degree in counseling and then worked at that university for about 5 years or so and decided that I wanted to get a PhD and wanted to learn more about psychology and the whole field, try to figure out a little more about what I was doing. So I went to the University of Florida for the doctoral program and spent about 6 years in Gainesville, Florida, getting the PhD, specializing in counseling psychology. It's a very long program, usually about 3 or 4 years worth of classwork, where you take all kinds of different seminars and training, as well as theoretical courses and practical courses where you get experience in what they call practicum placements. I worked at the VA hospital there in Gainesville for some of my practicum placements. I was fortunate while I was there, I got an assistantship, which means some funding. But for a graduate student to get funding, you have to earn it by doing some type of work. And I was able to get some funding, and part of the grant that we had allowed me to set up a computer lab to train people with visual impairments to use. At that time, I was working with the Apple II computer and some of the software that ran on the Apple II that had been written by David Holliday from Raise.Computing and Larry Skutkan from MicroTalk at that time. So I got to know those people and eventually finished school. After you do the 3 years of classwork, you have a 1 year internship where you go somewhere and practice psychology for a year with intensive supervision. Completed that and then took about a year to complete my PhD dissertation, which is a rather long study or paper, if you will, that you write where you conduct a study and you carry the study out and then you write up the results and submit it all, and it has to be approved by a committee, and it's quite an involved process. Usually takes 9 months to a year to complete. I graduated in 1989 and came down to Texas because there were some job openings here. I'd never been to Texas A&M, never really even heard of the town. Was called College Station, which is, I didn't know if that was a train station or what, but it turned out to be the town where the university is. Have actually been living here in College Station 20 years. And I do work in the student counseling service here on campus where I provide psychological and counseling services to any number of 45,000 students that we have.
How has psychology changed since you began?
It's changed quite a bit in the past 20 years. Most people seem to agree that we see more severe emotional and mental health issues on a college campus than what we saw 20 years ago. Part of that is attributed to the fact that there are much better psychotropic medications these days. And so people come to college now with more severe depression and anxiety and other mental health issues that are being controlled by medication. But a lot of times when they get here and get involved in the stress and strain of earning a degree and dealing with the social environment and all that goes into being a college student at a major university, they need and want more mental health care. And of course, that's a challenge for us to provide. We can't provide all the care that everyone needs. That's not possible. We have, in the area where I work, which is the personal counseling area, we have about 15 full-time psychologists, 4 psychology interns every year, and a number of what we call practicum students who are working on their degrees. But even that, even with 20-something of us seeing people, it still isn't enough to meet the needs of everyone. And of course, mental health in our country has really changed a lot. From 20, 30 years ago, there were mental hospitals that housed people who were in severe mental distress, but today, hospitals don't keep people for very long, and a lot of the mental hospitals aren't even in existence anymore. Yes, the environment landscape is quite different, and of course, there's the whole issue of the legalities of it and lawsuits, and we all have to carry substantial malpractice insurance in the event that a lawsuit, you know, should occur. Just like the medical community, there are lots of things on the horizon that we have to deal with.
Do any of your patients have any issue with your blindness?
When I was a graduate student, some of my professors were concerned and expressed concern about how people would deal with my blindness and how I would deal with the lack of nonverbal information, because in psychology, nonverbal information is so important when you're working with someone. You know, as I told them, and as has really turned out to be the case, I've been, for my whole life, living in a world of sighted people. So I've gotten pretty good at compensating when I'm dealing with someone who's not visually impaired. There are a lot of clues and a lot of cues, as I'm sure you know, about people's state. If they're agitated and moving around, of course, you can hear that. Or if they're becoming tearful, you can hear that in their voice. I can really just feel a lot of things in terms of the ambience or the mood in the room. And, you know, a lot of intuition and educated intuition comes into play when you're working in psychology. So the blindness has, I can only think of maybe 4 or 5 instances over the past 20 years where someone has said they did not want to work with me or weren't comfortable working with me because of my blindness. But 99.9% of the time, people not only are okay with it, but they will usually tell me that it's a comfort to them, that I'm not staring at them, trying to probe inside their mind, if you will, but that I'm able to sort of allow them to let their story unfold in a more natural way. So it's really turned out to be more of a strength than a problem for me, for the most part. And of course, if someone does have a problem with it, we will talk about it and see if we can work that through, because oftentimes just the process of working through that is a very good way of establishing rapport and building the kind of relationship that we need to do the psychological work that they've come there to do. But if not, I'm happy to refer them to someone else.
How do you determine that someone needs psychiatrist or some kind of prescription to assist them?
We have 2 psychiatrists on our staff, and so we work closely with them, and we have something that we call an initial appointment where we gather information and make some assessments about what a person needs. If it seems apparent that, as a lot of people can, that someone could benefit from a combination of counseling and a medication, then I can refer them to a psychiatrist and we can work together to provide a combined service. And really making those decisions is mostly a matter of experience and gathering the correct information and working closely with the people involved.
So I want to get into some of the common types of issues that you might deal with. First off, is substance abuse a problem on college campuses?
Yeah, substance abuse is actually a big problem. Alcohol is a major source of entertainment on a college campus. Binge drinking is very popular among college students. And for most students, you know, that's something that they do for a while and then sort of grow out of it or leave it behind. But for some, it leads to problems down the road. And we do work quite a bit with folks who are dealing with substance abuse issues. I really like a model of substance abuse treatment and work that was developed out of Washington State, which is called the harm reduction model, where we really try to help people work with what they're dealing with in ways that reduces harm but doesn't judge them or force them to absolute abstinence, which the AA model It's part of the work that we do, and it's a very interesting part, actually.
There's been a lot of discussion lately about maybe addictions to online gaming, things like World of Warcraft or things that would take people away from their studies, or internet addiction.
We do see some of that around the country on college campuses. The internet has changed in some ways, the good and bad of it. There can be the addictive quality. There can be the isolation that results from choosing to develop your support systems online as opposed to in person. But there can also be some real positives of it. We don't engage in any kind of online counseling or therapy, but there are places that do some of that. So some people get what they need or part of what they need, at least online. And of course, online opportunities have been very advantageous for some disabled groups, just as Saratech has really met a niche, I think, for people who can gather online who maybe for various reasons would have a hard time gathering in person. There are pros and cons to the whole new arena that we have to play in, which is the internet.
How has the internet helped you? I assume that there's ongoing training and education that you have to stay on top of. But how has the internet helped you stay on top of your work?
There's just an incredible amount of information on the internet relating to psychology, everything from Wikipedia and forums and user groups to research information from libraries and mental health facilities and other entities. So it's been a huge leveling of the playing field for me, because the information that once was only accessible in print in the library, which was certainly true when I was doing my PhD, we still relied on a lot of printed information in the library. All that information is now available online. That's been a wonderful thing. All of the paperwork that I do is done online and in an intranet that, of course, is not available to the world, but available to us in our center. And everything is web-based and easily accessible. So that certainly has changed the way that I work. The university requires us to do a certain amount of training courses that it basically requires all of its employees to do, faculty and staff. University policy, ethics, computing, all the training courses are available online. So I go and do them just like everybody else does. We're required to complete continuing education hours every year. Some of that information is available online. Some of it we have to actually attend courses in person. The internet has been a tremendous help to me in my work, and is honestly one of the things that makes me feel more optimistic about blind people going into psychology in the future, because I think it's going to be easier and easier for people to get the information that they need.
What would you encourage people to do if they have an interest in psychology as far as finding which schools they wish to receive their training in?
Just talked to someone the other day who was asking those kinds of questions. I encourage people to really think long and hard about, is this something that you really want? Because it's not a casual investment. If you're talking 4, 5, 6 years after an undergraduate degree to get a PhD in psychology, that's not trivial. It's not something that you want to take lightly. And of course, obviously, it's like anything. It's a little hard to know whether you really want it or not until you do it. But I encourage people to talk to people who are in the field, to read information that's out there that most university counseling services can help you provide. Most all of them have an academic and career component where they have information on the job market, information on what's required in a specific degree, information on schools that are approved by the American Psychological Association. And so the main thing is to collect and gather as much information as you can, both through talking to people and through reading and gathering. When you do make a decision, make it as much of an informed decision based on real information as you possibly can. I encourage people to look at different programs, to talk with people in those programs to try to find something that you feel will be a good match for you. Of course, there are requirements to get into programs. Virtually all of them require the GRE, the Graduate Record Exam. You need a decent score on that exam. You need to have good grades from your undergraduate transcript, needs to be in good shape. It's competitive to get into these graduate programs. There are a couple different kinds of programs in psychology. There's the traditional PhD, which is the Doctorate of Philosophy. That's more of a research-oriented, traditional educational kind of degree. And there's the other version of the PhD for psychology, which is called the PsyD, a degree that's issued by a professional school in psychology rather than a traditional university degree. You need to think about which route you want to take, and they're a little different in what they offer and the kind of training you end up with when you're done, but they both give you the credentials to work in the field. A lot of things to consider there.
They're also counselors as opposed to full-blown psychologists. Where does that come into play?
People can get master's degrees typically in counseling. Many universities have counselor education programs around the country. People who get these master's degrees in counseling can become what are called licensed professional counselors, or LPCs. They have to take pretty rigorous exam to get this license, as well as undergo a couple of years of rigorous supervision. These degrees allow them to work in a lot of different places, community mental health facilities. They can participate in independent practice or private practice. Sometimes they work in university settings. We have some of those folks working in our counseling center who provide academic and career counseling for students at the university. The people who provide the personal counseling where I work are licensed psychologists, but the lines have really blurred a lot over the years, and there's not such a difference anymore between licensed professional counselors and licensed psychologists. We need good people in the mental health field, and so there are a number of different ways to get there. They do differ in the types of jobs you'll end up doing and where you'll end up working.
So I'm curious what issues you might have with blind or visually impaired college students.
We do have disabled students on our campus. Most of them are learning disabled. The physically disabled population has grown some here, but we're primarily an engineering and agricultural school, and so traditionally people with disabilities have not been attracted to this university so much, although we do have a department here for students with disabilities. But my experience has been that students with disabilities deal with the same mental health issues across the board that everyone else does, and perhaps a little more sometimes in the area of confidence and how to manage on a campus. There's certainly oftentimes some mobility issues to take into consideration, and the stress of just living as a minority person on a campus of primarily people who do not deal with disability and all the issues that that brings to the table. You know, I always encourage my colleagues when they come to me and ask, how do I work with someone with this or that disability? I always say, well, first of all, I would just think about how you would work with that person without the disability, and the rest of it, I would encourage you to ask the person about what they need or what they want or how you can help them or how they would like you to deal with their disability. Kind of start with where they're at and go from there. I like to think that I listen well enough and care enough to start with each person from where they're at, not from some agenda maybe that I have some preconceived idea, because you find that everyone, if you really listen, has their own individual concern, and even if it's the same one that you've heard 1,000 times coming from that person, it has its own unique spin on it, and that's where you need to start.
I'd like you to talk about, I know, a tragedy that took place, I believe, in 1999 at Texas A&M, and how you dealt with that, counseling the students and even parents.
Yes, we had a tragedy for 100 years. It had been a tradition. Texas A&M is a very tradition-based university with lots of history and traditions and rich culture. A lot of it comes out of the fact that we are a large military institution. We used to be and still might be the largest military institution outside of the military academies. So we have a very large corps of cadets here at A&M. Traditionally, they had built a very, very large bonfire. I'm talking 100 feet tall, 90 feet tall, huge bonfire every year, which they would burn in a very large ceremony the night before Texas A&M played the University of Texas, which A&M considers to be their arch rival here in Texas. This was a huge project each fall where students participated in the cutting of logs and the building of this bonfire. In 1999, working on the bonfire a couple days before time to have the bonfire burning ceremony, which happens during a Thanksgiving week in the middle of the night around 3:30 in the morning. This huge bonfire, 90-some feet tall, with students out there working on it, putting the final touches on it. It collapsed, and 13 students were killed as a result of the collapse of the bonfire. And so this was a huge tragedy for our university. And so we immediately went into crisis intervention mode, where we worked for days and weeks and months with students who were devastated by this tragedy, as well as families. There's no amount of training, no amount of education that can prepare you, Mike, for dealing with this type of tragedy and devastation. So we really learned a lot about how to listen and how to be there for people without being overly intrusive, and a lot about, frankly, how to manage the media and try to deal with all of the people that come and want to help. And that's a great thing. I think about it. You know, all that going on in Haiti right now, where people come and they want to help and yet don't really know how to help, or there's no good organization in place for figuring out what needs to be done, and a lot of chaos, people upset and confused and frustrated. And what an experience that was. And it's been quite a healing process for this university.
Yeah, you mentioned the media, which I imagine really complicated things, just trying to sensationalize a very tragic event. Probably upsetting many people as they tried to get interviews.
Absolutely, and that's their job, I guess, to provide the story. But you're right, certainly a very different approach to dealing with people than how I'd like to see us all deal with each other.
Final thoughts, anything you'd like to leave us with?
Psychology has been a wonderful profession for me. I'm not done yet. I had always thought prior to finishing college that I would be a musician. I continue to play music. I'm married, my wife and my 17-year-old son, and we all do music together. So it's continued to be a really important part of my life. Psychology has been a really great profession for me. I thoroughly enjoy work with the students and honestly consider myself very honored, very fortunate to have been able to have the experiences of working with people that I've had over the years, and I'll always be grateful for those opportunities.
I know you are a fellow SAMNet member and you use System Access on occasion. I trust that's helpful to you either personally or professionally.
Absolutely. I have really become a major user of System Access and SAMNet, and have thoroughly enjoyed meeting the people who are on the service. I think Saratech's doing an awesome job, and I've become quite a big fan over the last year and a half.
So what about hobbies? You read books, you play music. I know you've recently gotten back involved with the Macintosh. You started out, I guess, Apple IIe, and you've gone full circle.
Oh, absolutely. Very involved with the Mac. In fact, I'm talking to you on my Mac right now on the Skype. It's the primary computer that I use. Still use Windows at work because we're required to, but I also carry my Mac laptop with me to work every day and use it there for mail. And I'm really into the iPhone these days, into these portable players, the BookSense and the Braille Plus and the Victor Reader Stream and all those players that we have. I love those little players for some reason. Yeah, I do love to read. My background as an English major has continued with me throughout my life, and read tons of books. Read at least part of the New York Times newspaper every day and try to stay up with the news. And of course, you and I are on Twitter and we keep up with things that way. The technology is a huge part of my life. I'm really proud to call myself a geek, and I consider the technology to be a major piece of what I'm into. I'm a ham radio operator. I'm active in our local amateur radio club and get on the air when I can. I have a station set up here that pretty much covers all the bands. Have some friends who developed some really cool access technology for me to access the frequencies on my radio, and even to an audible indicator to tell me which direction my antenna is pointed. I'm never lacking for something to do, and even when I retire in a few years from my work at the university, I have no doubt that I'll have plenty to keep me busy.
Obviously, you can't, for legal and ethical reasons, provide any kind of counseling or assistance to people, but would you like to maybe give an email address where people can speak to you? Maybe they're interested in going into the career?
Yeah, if someone's interested in the career, you know, has questions about that aspect of it, I'd be happy to correspond with someone. Of course, you're absolutely correct that I cannot provide any type of counseling or psychological services to people. That would be inappropriate and unethical, and I wouldn't do that. But if someone would like to contact me about it, the email that I normally give out would be r-carter, C-A-R-T-E-R, @suddenlink.net. That's SUDDENLINK.net. R-Carter@sudlink.net. Be happy to communicate with anyone.
You've been listening to Serotalk. Visit us at www.serotalk.com. Send us an email at resources@serotalk.com or leave us a voicemail at 866-997-BLAB-2522. We may read your email or play your voicemail in the next podcast. Join us in 2 weeks as we explore all the internet and life has to offer. Until then, may you have an accessible digital life.